Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. First one on the list is Cyrus Sassel, or Kyrus S-A-S-L. I don't know how you say this stuff. Cyrus Sassel stands for Simple Authentication and Security Layer, or rather, Cyrus Sassel is an implementation of Sassel, which stands for Simple Authentication and Security Layer. And Sassel, as defined by RFC 4422, is a... Actually, the text here says RFC 2222, but I don't think that's right. I think it's 4422. RFC 2222. Simple Authentication Security Level. Layer. Okay, so it is 2222. Sorry, Pat. Okay, what is 4422? It's also Simple Authentication and Security Layer. Okay, so I was right, and Pat Volkerding is also right. Whatever RFC refers to, it is a system. This specifically is a library that enables applications to verify the identity of a specific kind of server, and the kinds of servers that it handles would be definitely IMAP, XMPP, and then several others. And I don't know them off the top of my head, but it can talk to a lot of different network services, and it can handle various kinds of authentication. That includes plain text, P-L-A-I-N, plain. Plain text, authentication. It can handle Kerberos. It can certainly handle things talking over star TLS and OpenSSL and all of those kinds of encryption protocols. So the way Cyrus Sassel authenticates depends really on the protocol you are using, and then the method of verification that protocol provides. And different ones provide different methods, and your application might use a variety of different methods within Cyrus Sassel. Cyrus Sassel, for instance, can use, an SQL database, but it can also use a shared secret and other methodology. So lots of different options, and Cyrus Sassel just makes all of those things available to an application, which is good because I think more and more these days, network-aware applications, they kind of are starting to kind of merge a lot of times, you know, like an application that provides one happens to also provide the other, or a server that provides one wants to also provide the other. So it's kind of nice to have a library that provides a lot of different options. And that was the end of the C portion of the N package set. So the next one is simply called Daemon, or Daemon, however you pronounce it, or however you prefer to pronounce it. It's Daemon, really, but at least as a kid, when looking through fantasy books, I would see Daemon and Daemon in the same book, and so you kind of have to pronounce it differently. The E-M-O-N as opposed to a D-A-E-M-O-N, it's like it mattered which one it was. So anyway, Daemon. It turns other processes into a daemon. And so this is part of a larger toolkit called libslack, which I don't know if it has any relationship to Slackware. It is just libslack.org. Daemon is just one command from that, from the larger toolkit. I don't know why it's the only one included, or maybe it's not. Maybe there are others and I'm just not noticing, or I'm not putting them sort of together in my head, but Daemon is certainly a thing from libslack. You can go to libslack.org or go to codeberg.org/raforg/libslack, and this provides a little bit of context for the overall set of tools. It has a nice little quote by J.R. Bob Dobbs, and a couple of sort of a description of the different commands and libraries that would that you could use from the libslack set. Now, it looks like Daemon has, where did I have that here? It does look like this daemon package is, it's just the command daemon. So it is not like the library itself, like the header files, the library, you know, it is just this daemon command. So you're not going to be using libslack with daemon. You're the thing that we are talking about right now is called daemon. It is a command, and it turns something into a daemon. And to see the way that you use it, type in daemon --- help, and it gives you a list of things that you can do. I'm trying to think of a thing that we could turn into a daemon, and I'm just really drawing a blank. But if you can think of something, you can turn it into a daemon with --- foreground, and that'll run the thing into in the foreground. So I guess I could do like sleep, I don't know, 11. And so now I'm running sleep as a daemon, I guess, for 11 seconds. And that just ties up my prompt, obviously. Doesn't really do anything very useful, but it does run it as a daemon. And when you run something as a daemon, of course, it's technically running sort of in the background. And you have options within daemon that can, you can name the thing, you can name your daemon. So --- name equals, you could call it something unique then that you'd be able to identify. You can do a --, what is it, respawn, which respawns the client should it terminate, which you could imagine would be, I mean, that's kind of the feature of what a daemon is. I mean, aside from running in the background, a daemon also is ideally always running. That's your expectation. So if you --, respawn, then should something bad happen, your daemon crashes, then it's going to respawn. And you can adjust how quickly it tries to respawn as well. If for some reason you think that it would need time to, I don't know, clean up. I mean, if it crashed, I don't think it would do this anyway. But say you wanted to leave a little bit of time between the crash and the restart to clean up temporary files or something like that, then you could do a --- respawn, but then a --- delay equals, and then you tell it to delay between respawn attempts in so many seconds. So the example to the daemon command is that you can use it to run anything as a daemon. So again, I can't actually think of a use case, and I've been trying. I thought of one where it was like, well, maybe it could be sort of watching a directory, and when media appears in that directory, then convert it. But I couldn't really figure out how to get it to stop, like, not, you know, not to not to only do something once something is there. And I couldn't figure, yeah, it didn't feel like it was worth running as a daemon, to be honest. But I guess that would actually be a valid example. That could work if you had a directory where you're expecting something to happen, some file to appear in that directory. And once it does, you want to do something with that directory. Then you could run that as a daemon. I mean, you could also just do it as a cron job, probably. But I don't know. A daemon is a little bit different. You could check every, I don't know, couple of seconds for the presence of a file or something. So that would be one thing that you could do. I think I can see the library being a little bit more useful, but that's, again, not what we're talking about here. This is not libslack, header files, and libraries. This is just daemon. So I don't know exactly what I would use this for, and I guess the fact that I haven't used it, nor could I come up with a use case for myself, I guess that says something. But, you know, whether I have an immediate use for it or not doesn't really matter in terms of, like, whether this is a really useful command to have. And it is. It's one of those commands that I'm really, really glad that we have, because you just know there's going to be a time where you think, I just need this command to run over and over, just, you know, upon, in expectation of some thing happening, and you can just do it with daemon. You can just make that happen, and that's a nice feature. That's cool. You have something that will just keep restarting a process for you, or that'll keep running that process for you until something, or, you know, so that when something happens, it can respond. That's a real, I think, kind of a nice, quick, superpower to have, even if I haven't used it and cannot think of a use case for it immediately. Okay. Next up is dehydrated.io. This is a Let's Encrypt Acme setup script. This is great. This is, I was just talking about SSL not too long ago. We were talking about the CA certification package in the C portion of the IN packages. And I cited Let's Encrypt as one of the things that I think really for me makes SSL useful. And that is that now everyone's got SSL. It's not something that you have to just buy into. It's just everyone's got SSL when they need it. And the reason that they have it is because of Let's Encrypt. Well, Dehydrated is kind of a front end for AcmeBot, which is the thing that helps you sign a certificate that's within the Let's Encrypt implementation. Or I guess really technically it's zero SSL implementation or something like that. I don't get the sense that this is any like easier or less easy than using AcmeBot directly or whatever it's called. I think it's called AcmeBot. I haven't had to do that manually in a while, but I mean I don't remember it, that being very complex. And looking at this command, dehydrated doesn't look all that like, it doesn't look more or less complex. It looks sort of like, yeah, it's a command that manipulates your certificate keys. So, or your certificates rather. I don't think it seems like something that you would ditch one over the other for. But on the other hand, if you don't have one and you do have the other, then hey, you could use it. So Dehydrated is on your system right now, so you can use it rather than something else, which is a nice convenience to have. So that makes one good argument to use Dehydrated. Certainly if you're setting up SSL, you've got everything you need on Slackware. You've got Dehydrated, you can go for it. And also you've got 2,000 lines of a shell script. I mean, Dehydrated is just, I mean, so is AcmeBot last time I checked. Maybe they've rewritten it in Go or something. I don't remember, but I feel like last time I checked, it was all just a shell script. But Dehydrated is also a shell script. Look at it. It's really, really nicely coded. If you just need to sort of reinforce good habits into your bash coding, this is definitely some really nice coding. So I would definitely take a look. I mean, it's in user bin right now. Just open it up in a pager, like more or less or most. I recommend less. And look through it. It is a nice little script. But more to the point, it's a script for dealing with SSL. If you are running a website from your computer, then definitely give it an SSL cert through Let's Encrypt. Use Dehydrated to do that. Next up, DHCP. This is it. This is the DHCP server and client package. I used to use this very, very directly. So if I do a /var/logs/packages/DHCP-4. You've got important utilities like DH client. That's a really, really important one because that is what your computer uses to obtain a DHCP address if it has not been given one by some router. Now nowadays this is all done automatically for you with Network Manager. As long as you're running that, you're gonna join a network. You're gonna get your DHCP address, or rather your IP address from the DHCP server, and you're not gonna think about it. But at one point you could sort of join a network and then request an IP address through DHCP. DH client kind of forced that to occur if it hadn't already happened. And it's a useful little script, DH client. The other component, that's the client script, as its name implies, DH client. The other component of this, though, is the DHCPD, the daemon that hands out IP addresses in the event that you're running a DHCP server on Slackware. You don't want to do this on a network that's already running a DHCP server. Trust me, it's a really bad idea. You get collisions of IP addresses and your entire network will be brought down. It's hugely bad, and it is not easy to fix, frankly. You'd think, well, just that ever happens, I'll just stop one of the DHCP servers. And yes, you can kind of do that, but trust me, things get, like, in their memory, things start to remember that, oh, this was my former address, and then you get weird collisions after the fact because they're all scrambling for the same thing. It's really, really bad. Don't do it. But if you're not running a DHCP server on your network, you could run one on Slackware. Now, your Slackware machine would need to be on all the time, basically, because anything joining your network is going to want to get an IP address, and so you need a DHCP server running to hand out those addresses. The package lists an example configuration file, but honestly, it's not really much of a file. It has like a comment at the top saying that this is a DHCP conf file or something like that. So not terribly useful, not like the bind one. But the man page, the man dhcp.conf, is quite good and provides a very good example. It's not that complex, really. You define a subnet and your net mask, and you put that in sort of a little function stanza surrounded by curly braces. So for instance, it could be something like subnet 192.168.0.0, net mask 255.255.255.0. You could constrain it more, but let's just go with 0 to keep it simple. Curly brace range 192.168.0. Let's say, I don't know, 50, not 20. Let's just say 20. So 20, and then the space 192.168.0.254. So I'm arbitrarily saying 20. Of course, we could actually say 192.168.0.1 to 254. That would be well within our subnet definition, which is no net, you know, the net mask on the final digit. It's wide open, so you can have all the hosts. But I'm saying let's constrain it to start at 20 so that the lower numbers, like 1 through 19, could be reserved for infrastructure stuff. I don't even know if we need 20, but let's just assume 20's what we want. So that would be one thing you would want to do is define where your router is. Option space routers space 192.168.0. Let's say that's at 1 semicolon, and then the range. Did I put a semicolon after the range? Put a semicolon after the range. You could define your lease time, the maximum lease time before something has to renew, and so on. You can also define like groups and hosts. So like host, my server, curly brace, hardware, Ethernet, and then the MAC address, semicolon. And then you could say, okay, that host, my server.local or whatever I said, with a hardware Ethernet of this MAC address, semicolon, let's make that a fixed dash address, and you could give it 192.168.0.19, or yeah, 19. That would be the one right up against the our dynamic address pool, semicolon, close curly brace. And I guess if we're still in the subnet, then again, close curly brace. So it is not a very complex configuration file, as long as you kind of know the function of DHCP, you kind of understand why you would have a DHCP server, and presumably you'll have gone into your router at some point in the past and done things like adjusting your subnet, manipulating your net mask, manipulating the static hosts and dynamic address pools and things like that. If you've not done any of that, then honestly, I think, and I'm speaking from, experience here. Yeah, I think experience, is you go into your router and you do that sort of thing. You mess around with what your network looks like. Is it set to 192.168 or Do you set it to 10.0 dot something? What is the netmask? Do you just set it to 0.255.255.255.0, or do you do something crazy like 255.255.255.224? And when you do that, what does that leave you? How many hosts can you actually have on your network then? It's 30 hosts to 224, because 254. This is how I remember it. 254. Well, I mean, how do I remember this? 252 gives you two addresses for your subnet. So, you know, in a weird world where you set it to 254 for some reason, which you would never do because that would give you zero hosts on your subnet, then 254 minus 224 is 30. So you can get 30. And similarly, if you set it to 248, you could take, again, in the weird world where you put 254 as your subnet mask, which, again, you would not do. But if you did, you'd get zero. So then 248 would give you what? 254 minus 248 is something like, I don't know, 6? 48 plus, yeah, 2 and then 4, right? Yeah. So 6 and so on. So mess around with that sort of thing. And then you can eventually, you get an idea of how DHCP, not necessarily how it works, but what values are sensible. And then the configuration becomes, I think, even easier. Next up from DHCP is DHCPD, which is a, no, sorry, DHCPCD, which I also used quite a lot. Which is the client daemon for DHCP. So it's a DHCP client daemon. And this one, this is just as easy as DH client, really. And I don't exactly know why both are included. It pings a DHCP server that it finds on the network and requests an IP address. It also tries to renew your IP address, but I don't recall me ever having a computer on long enough for the least time. I mean, I may have, but not consciously. I feel like that's more of a thing for a long-term, you know, where you're not shutting your computer off. Because otherwise, I mean, when you're shutting your computer down, you're losing your DHCP CD, the client daemon. It's going away because you're closing your computer or shutting it down or whatever. So I don't imagine that was a real feature that I needed. But it is quite simple. It is literally just you type in DHCP CD, you get an IP address. It may or may not work if you try it now. I mean, there's a lot of other stuff probably running on your computer that would possibly either interfere with it or prevent it from, well, that's the same thing, isn't it? Okay, so DNS mask is next. That's the small DNS and DHCP server. So DHCP is optional. I think a lot of people run DNS mask mostly as a DNS forwarder. So this is kind of the implementation of bind and it does basically the same thing. I mean, this is at least as I was talking about bind, this is exactly that. And if you look at the entry for this package, DNS, what is it? DNS mask, right? Yeah. Mask spelled with a Q. There is a configuration file, a sample configuration file. Let's take a look at that. See if it's very useful or not very useful. It's very useful. Yeah, there's a lot here. So it looks to me like you could, you can do this. Yeah. So I remember this. So this configuration file is quite useful. It's well commented. It is one of those configuration files that you can kind of just step through it and, you know, read and do what it tells you to do. I mean, there's some confusion, you know, like here, replies which are not DNSSEC signed may be legitimate because the domain is unsigned or maybe forgeries. Setting this option tells DNS mask to check that. An unsigned reply is okay by finding a secure proof that a DS record somewhere between the root and the domain does not exist. The cost of setting this is that even queries in unsigned domains need one or more extra DNS queries to verify. And the option to uncomment is DNSSEC-check-unsigned. What would you do? Would you leave that commented, or would you uncomment it? I don't know. It feels okay to uncomment, but I don't know. Is it? Like, do we need that? Do we want that? Who knows? You can uncomment it. Change this line if you want DNS to get its upstream servers from somewhere other than /etc/resolve.conf. So as you can see, by default, DNS mask with a Q looks to your /etc/resolve.conf file to figure out where its default name servers are. So if you look at /etc/resolve, no E, just resolve.conf. And if you look in that, then you see that you have name servers set by something, probably not yourself, but maybe. But a lot of times this is set by something else, like network manager or some daemon that runs to check what this should be set at, you know, whatever you're running. So by default, DNS mask looks to this to figure out what to do in the event that it can't find an entry for a host that it's looking for. So this is and hosts are listed, which this configuration file does kind of say in a roundabout way. They're listed in /etc/hosts. And that's important to realize. So DNS mask, when you ask for example.local or, you know, myserver.local, whatever, let's go with example.local, I guess. When you ask for example.local, that obviously doesn't exist. It's a .local address. That doesn't make any sense. It wouldn't exist on the internet. So when you ask a network with running DNS mask on it for example.local, DNS mask first checks the /etc/hosts file on the machine that it's, you know, on the same machine on its server. Like, this is your DNS mask server, so it looks at your /etc/hosts file and looks for example.local. If there's no entry for example.local, then DNS mask looks at /etc/resolve.conf, looks for a valid name server, and then checks that name server for example.local. Now, in this scenario, it wouldn't, if it didn't find example.local in /etc/hosts, certainly not going to find it on the DNS network, right? On the DNS name system server, domain name server system, whatever. DNS is not going to have example.local, but let's say that you were looking for mastodon.xyz. What a weird domain that is. Is it in your /etc/hosts? No, it's not. Okay, well, let's look at /etc/resolve.conf, find a name server, and then go out onto the DNS of the internet and look up mastodon.xyz. Oh, there it is. It exists. Let's go to that site. And that's the process. So it looks in your hosts file for a special name. And if the special name isn't there, it goes to wherever you have your DNS server set to. And that's what DNS mask does. DNS mask, the server itself, you would be running it on your Slackware machine, and now it's running on your network. And so it is now making essentially your /etc/hosts file available to your entire network. The question is, and this is a very important question to ask anytime you're setting up a network server, is does your network know that your DNS mask, that your service is available? And of course, in this scenario, no. There are two ways to let your network know that, hey, you're running a DNS mask server now. One is you go to your router and you find your DNS, your name server entries, and you put in your whatever computer you're running, your Slackware box. You put your Slackware box as the name server for your router. That way, all computers connecting to your router get the same same setting, and so all of a sudden they're all coming to you, to your Slackware computer first for DNS information. So you would want your Slackware box to always be on, because if you shut that down, the rest of your network doesn't know where the internet is. Or it knows where the internet is, it just doesn't know what all those names that you're providing it mean. It can't look up the numbers for the names. The other way to do that is to turn your router DHCP service off. Now, this will break things if you do that. at first, initially, it will, everything will lose its IP address. No one will know how to get to the router. Bad things happen. But I mean, that's, don't panic. What you have to do then, or at that point, in order to fix this problem that you've just created, is to use DNS mask as your DHCP server, which it can also do as long as you configure it to do that. And that is in the dnsmask.conf file in /etc. It's about, I don't know, 50 example of PTR, add domain, address, add IP queries. You can control DNS mask. I don't know where it is. It's about line 100 or so. Yep, there it is, actually. If you want DNS, so line 102, if you want DNS mask to listen for DHCP and DNS requests on specified interfaces, give the name of the interface here. So you can activate at line 100 or so, read through the configuration file and activate the settings to have DNS mask serve as your DHCP server. And it'll be very similar to either your router or if you were messing around with DHCPD, it's basically the same kind of information. You know, it's kind of like, well, here's my domain name that I want to assign to this subnet. Here's the subnet boundaries. Here's the net mask. Here's the DHCP range I want to hand out. Here are some reserved ones that I want to assign to specific computers, that kind of thing. So it'll all be relatively familiar. And now your Slackware computer running DNS mask would be providing not only DHCP, the IP addresses for through DHCP, but also it will have the setting that your computers are looking for when they are wondering where to go for DNS information. And that setting will be your Slackware computer. So then all of the computers on your network come to your Slackware computer for DNS information. First they go to your Slackware box for for an IP address. And when you hand them that information, then they also get DNS settings information as well. Okay, we may as well, I don't want to, but we may as well end the D section in the N package set, and that is Dovecot. Dovecot is an open source IMAP and POP3 server. So this is an email server, and it can use inbox format for emails or MailDir format. There are people who like one and dislike the other. It kind of depends on sort of a lot of different philosophies on how you like to sort information or what your email client wants to use. And it is, it'll do IMAP or POP3. So IMAP, of course, you can allow clients to sign on and read email straight from the server, or you can have clients set to use POP3 and just download the messages and remove them from the server. And yes, all of this happens through the magic of Cyrus Sassel. So that's very useful. Or actually, does it Cyrus specifically or just Sassel? It might be just Sassel built into Dovecot. I'm not sure. Either way, setting up a mail server, as you've probably heard in the modern day and age, is not a trivial activity. It is something that requires a heck of a lot of work. Not only the configuration and setting up of it, you have to have a firewall set up. You have to have a good firewall configuration. You need a database to manage all those users and passwords. You have to have a bunch of required system level users and groups and things like that. You need SSL. You have to have your DNS records configured, you know, like the big ones on the internet, because the internet needs to find your mail server, specifically an MX record. You need a postfix configuration for that database. You need to configure Dovecot itself, so you know how you're going to get the mail in, how you're going to sort it and distribute it, how you're going to get the mail out, and so on. And you need to decide whether you're using a virtual mail system, or whether your mail system is a direct translation of the users on your machine. So in other words, if I have a computer with CLAT2 and Gort as users on the computer, a mail server, strictly speaking, would have Klaatu and Gort. Those would be the two email addresses of that domain. A virtual mail system, you can abstract that away and add all the users that you want, but they don't. Those users just exist in a database. They don't actually exist on the computer. They're not system, you know, they're not users of the computer. They're just people for whom you have accounts on that domain. So all of that needs to be configured. And as fun as that sounds for me to do a whole series on that, first of all, I don't believe I'm qualified. I would probably give incorrect information. And second of all, there's a lot of sort of nuance there depending on what kind of setup you would want. And then finally, there's really a lot of reasons not to do this, as you've, again, probably heard. Email servers are one of the most popular targets on the internet. Practically everyone I've met who has run one has said that at some point during their tenure as email server admin, they've been, you know, they've had their domain like blacklisted or banned or something added to some list because of, you know, because something was open and they were relaying emails or accepting requests from somewhere that they didn't even realize they were doing. So it's a tall order to do that on today's internet. I think everyone pretty much recommends against it. So I'm not going to recommend it myself. I think it's probably more realistic to use an email server from any given popular service. And if you are interested in private communication, then use encryption, GPG, something like that, so that your comms are encrypted. And then you don't have to worry so much about who's, you know, got your information and who's looking at that information, because what they've got and what they see is a bunch of just random or seemingly random characters, and only on the client machine do those messages get unencrypted, decrypted. So that's probably the way to go. But if you want to run Dovecot, you can, and it's here in Slackware, and it wasn't here in previous editions, as far as I recall. In 14.0 and .1, was there a 14.2? I keep forgetting. Either way, previously I don't recall there being a Dovecot included. You could build it from slackbuilds.org, but now it's here. It's pretty much good to go with a bunch of example configuration files, but you do have to go through all of those and choose your settings, because there's just so many different ways to set this up. So that's Dovecot. I feel like I've not done it justice really at all, but on the other hand, I don't feel like it's fair for me to attempt to do it justice, because I wouldn't be the person to give good advice on running an email server on today's internet. So I won't. If you really feel like you want to learn how to do an email server, which is perfectly acceptable, then probably the way to do that would be to set up a virtual network, configure it with its own little DNS system so that you can have your local DNS addresses, and then install Slackware and Dovecot into that environment using local DNS stuff so that you're really kind of guarded from the rest of the internet, and mess around with it in a virtualized setting. I think that would be a reasonable way to go about learning more. And there really is great documentation on the process on docs.slackware.com. There's a really good article about setting it up. I mean, I shouldn't say article. There's an article, and then there are like 8 sub-articles that you have to click into to, you know, for your firewall and for your DNS settings and all, you know, your Dovecot and your database configuration, all the things that you have to do. I do believe it's a little bit outdated. It was written back in the 14.x days, but it's still a very good article, and reading that I think would give you a good idea of where to get started. So I will do the easy thing and refer you to docs.slackware.com for email configuration. But again, not really sure that that's what you really, really want to do. I mean, heck, even the corporations that I've worked at so far, very few of them are actually even running their own email servers anymore. They're all farming it out to some other entity. usually Google. And I'm talking about unilaterally. Like, I have not, I don't know of a company that goes to the trouble of running its own email service at this point. And you might think, well, if no one's running it, who's running this stuff? Like, why does this software even exist? And I think part of that answer is that some of the providers are probably running some of this software. And the other is, you know, for niche, really, really niche interests, sometimes I think some of this does exist. But it's an uncommon thing. And I think that's a bigger conversation that really the tech industry, the internet, needs to kind of have at some point. And I've seen the conversation happen. I don't think we've by any means come to any kind of resolution around it. But like the big question, I think, is if we want open source services, like how do we make that happen? Like how can just an average user be kind of a self-sufficient open source node on a larger cluster, if you will, or mesh, if you will? How can we do that? And there have been lots of different ideas about this. And I think one of the closest things that we've gotten yet right now is Nextcloud. Nextcloud isn't perfect. I mean, it's a tall order to be perfect. Nextcloud isn't perfect, but with one install of Nextcloud, which is not amazingly difficult. I've got it installed on some pretty surprising places, like places that you know, it's just like a normal VPS account without any root privileges. You can run Nextcloud on a surprising array of things. And when you do, you have a bunch of services just kind of right there at your fingertips. Like you have access to the federated network, like to Mastodon, that kind of thing. You have access to peer-to-peer video chat and things like that. Of course, so you get past that barrier, and yes, now you've got, well, okay, so Nextcloud exists. Okay, well, what do you run that on? Who's truly got a device that is on all the time? Like, I mean, many of us do, like in our pocket, on our phone. Are you going to run Nextcloud on your phone? Like, you know, because Nextcloud, I mean, because these services exist, but they require devices that are just on all the time. And that kind of makes you think of, like, you know, back in the 90s, where the mythical 90s, I don't actually know that this happened, but an urban legend has it that some major company had one of the early websites. And when people would go there after 5 o'clock in the afternoon, in whatever time zone, let's say Pacific time, the website was gone. It was down. And they couldn't figure out why. What's happening? Turns out, you know, urban legend, that the secretary at the end of the day would shut down all the computers and go home. And it turns out that the web server, was just a spare computer off in the corner. And when the secretary shut everything down and went home, the web server was being shut down. And then it would get turned on every day at 9 a.m. So, you know, like, you couldn't do that on your own. If you want your own email server, you want your own Mastodon node, whatever, then you need that device that's always on. And yeah, there are Raspberry Pis, and there's desktops, and there's all these things that we could have on theoretically all the time, but like there's a global infrastructure of stuff that's really, really on all the time. And that's a hard thing to beat. And you think, well, you know what, I could, maybe in an alternate reality, we could just live with things that just were kind of on sporadically. Well, sure, until until someone sends an email that then never reaches you because your device wasn't on at the time, and then they turned their device off before you turned yours back on. You know, it's just like, it wouldn't work, really. Or would it? I mean, maybe there is a solution to this, but I don't think that's kind of where we're headed. I mean, it doesn't seem like where we're headed. What with the cloud and the clusters and the things like that, I think it much more seems like we're building public, ideally public infrastructure that is just always on. And if you want a slice of that infrastructure pie, then you can get your slice one way or another, whether it's supported by advertisements or something that you pay for separately or something that you pay for and advertisements. And that's kind of the way that we're going. But I think it is an interesting exercise, you know, to just imagine like what kind of infrastructure could be built whereby all of these services are just apps on devices. And when you sign up for an email address, you're just opening your email server app and creating yourself an account and declaring a domain or something. And that's your email server. And when you turn off your device, it goes away, but maybe other devices are storing things that have yet to reach you in an encrypted format or something. Who knows? You know, like we can think of all kinds of weird sort of solutions. I don't think this is where we're headed, but it's an interesting thought exercise. And I think it's just kind of a harsh reality that the old model of, well, here's my bare metal server, and here are these applications, these demons, these services that I'm going to run on bare metal. I'm going to hack on the configuration files until all of the weird looking options that are somewhat explained through really poorly written comments are exactly what I think I need them to be, and then I'll just hope for the best, and we'll see if it works. And then once it does work, then you have to, as I've said, throw up a bunch of firewalls and configure a bunch of things out there on that public infrastructure again, because remember, the DNS, the entire DNS structure is just a big public infrastructure device. I don't think that has rendered an independently sort of open source default in most of the population. I imagine most of us, dear listener, are not running our own email servers. I imagine many of us are not running our own Mastodon instance. I imagine we're probably not hosting our own Jitsi server for video conferences and so on. So all of these tools are out there. They're services that you kind of sign up for one way or another. And if they're open source, then that's nice, but are you really interacting with the source code? You may or may not be. I think a lot of us are not. And so, you know, you kind of start to wonder, like, what does it actually matter? And I think probably for many of us, if not most of us, it doesn't ultimately matter. It's just you need this thing. Well, you're going to go sign up for the thing. And I couldn't tell you what kind of back end my email provider actually runs. Like I can take some guesses, but I mean, I couldn't tell you for sure. They might be farming everything out to Google for all I know. I really don't know. So it's a perplexing kind of state of open source right now, because everything is so far removed in terms of those public facing ports. You might be running a bunch of open source on your computer, but a lot of those services you don't really know that much about. And there's not really an easy way for us as open source enthusiasts to fix that. Our choices are sign up for Gmail or run your own email server. I mean, those are bad choices. Both of those choices are not great. Now, I think there's a third choice that, you know, aside from my imaginary thought exercise, let's figure out a different way to do it. There's the third choice of like kind of not hedging your bets, but coming up with alternatives, really. Like, because I remember for a very long time, the official line among a lot of people was, well, I don't even use email anymore. I don't like email. Email's doesn't work for me. Which, I mean, okay, great, except everyone else is using email. So realistically, I don't know how that would work. But on a pragmatic level, maybe you don't use email anymore and you choose to just use an open source chat client. And maybe that's your option. You're running that client yourself, more or less, although you're still probably depending on a service to make sure you get those chats. But yeah, actually, this third option isn't actually working out so well for me as I talk it through. So yeah, maybe there's not an easy answer. Maybe there really isn't an easy answer. And we do have to either fall back on the imagine. No, you could use Nextcloud. That's the, that, Third option, Nextcloud. You're now running your own Nextcloud instance, and it gives you chat. And you need to get all the people that you want to talk to on chat or on Mastodon so you can chat sort of that way. So there needs to be some, you know, that's the eternal other problem, is interfacing with the rest of the world. So lots of different layers, really complex to set up, either literally through text files or to set up sort of literally with the people in your life who you want to chat with. And who knows? I mean, what's the right solution? I mean, I really think that the right solution for me, in theory, is Nextcloud. Like that model, it doesn't have to be Nextcloud, but I mean, it could be. I quite like Nextcloud. But I mean, that I think that's the model, you know? Like, here's a thing, not too hard to set up. You need a server that's always on. But I mean, for most people, that's attainable. You can either buy one, like rent one, or you can run it, you know, in your house. Like, it just kind of depends on your means and your preferences. And then once you have that, you're in. You've got a bunch of services on there. And I think if that sort of model could progress, I think that would be a real win for open source. Whether it's going to progress that much and whether other people think about it this much or not, I don't know. But anyway, that's what Dovecot made me think about. In the next episode, we'll take some listener feedback and chat about, I don't know, coffee. Not next week, but the week after, which is May 2 through 12. I'll be in Denver, Colorado for the Red Hat Summit Conference for work. So if you're in Denver, Colorado, or if you're at the Red Hat Summit yourself, let me know. We can meet up for coffee or something. This shouldn't affect the podcast schedule. I've got episodes recorded, and I'll use the @ command to transfer them over into the directory that they need to be in. There should be no service interruption, but just so you know, that's what's happening the first couple of weeks of May. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time. Thanks for listening. My name's Klaatu. You can reach me anytime over email with feedback or comments, tips, or just to say hi. My email address is klaatu@slackermedia.info. You can also reach me on the Mastodon network, not Klaatu, at mastodon.xyz. The show's intro and outro music is by Fat Chance Lester. You can find their music on bandcamp.com or on gnuworldorder.info. In the archive, you'll find a music directory containing the album from which this music has been extracted. Until next time, thanks for listening, and keep the source open.
With his stories.